The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And I feel a little bit apologetic that I don't have an Earth Day talk prepared. And it would have been nice. I'd like to do this in two parts today. One is to the one more announcement is that today is the last day for the online auction, and it's really also the last day of our kind of major fundraising for our retreat center. It's hard to imagine trying to fundraise anymore, appropriately, and now we're in the thick of the renovation of the place. So in 6 months we'll have a retreat center, and we're kind of teetering financially on the edge of what we can do, and we keep kind of struggling or kind of trying hard to figure out what can we afford to do, and we keep taking things out of the project and then sneak things back in and take things out, and that's maybe as it should be, but we're still fundraising, and today's our last big day, and with this auction, this wonderful auction, which represents the generosity of many, many people. All those things are people who have come forward from this community and from right away, far, far away, who wanted to support this by offering something. I think it's a beautiful thing. And Michelle Aiden, who's there, it's been her gift to our community to put a tremendous amount, her and her husband, tremendous amount of time and effort into organizing and creating the auction. Thank you. And she's here with her laptop. Because if some of you want to participate in the auction but find it a little bit difficult or challenging to navigate the website that has the online auction, that's what her laptop is here for. She'll help you and help you find your way through it if you want to do that. Okay, so now the talk. So I want to do it in two parts. And first, I want to tell you a classic story from the ancient times, from the Buddha's time, and then try to somehow apply that story or the key teaching of the story to our lives. The climax of the story is the Buddha teaching a particular verse, 4-line verse, which became a very important verse in the history of Theravadan Buddhism, and sometimes is used almost as an encapsulation of the Buddha's teaching. And in the ancient world, people would there are inscriptions that have been found. People put this verse on the inscriptions, and maybe the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness is holds certain things in the American psyche. So this particular verse is very important. So the story has to do with the Buddha's chief disciple. His name is Sariputta, the son of Sari. Sari is his mother's name. So he had a very good friend who was also one of the chief disciples of the Buddha named Mahamoggallana. And they grew up in the same town. They were born around the same time and grew up they were Brahmins, grew up together. And being Brahmins, they were given some of the best education that was available in India at the time. And so highly educated in all the things that you could be educated in back then, including philosophy and religion and logic. And they grew up together. And then at some point, there was a festival in their town, 3-day festival. And the way I read the story is that they paid entrance fee the first day and participated in the festival with great delight, laughing with all the funny things and doing festival things. And so they decided to go back the next day, and so they paid their tickets for the next day and participated as well, or laughed and enjoyed it. Then they went back the third day. And the third day they were sitting, kind of watching the festival, and they reflected, these two friends, about, you know, kind of seeing people doing party things. Maybe you've been on the outside of a party wondering, what are they doing? Sometimes. I don't know exactly how they, but they're sitting kind of watching the whole thing, and they had this reflection that in 100 years, all this will be gone. And somehow the contrast of 100 years from now and how temporary this particular festival is, the partying, whatever it was, gave a very different context for wanting to participate in it. And they had a sense there must be something different, some other possibility in life than just partying. And so they, in India at that time, they already had this idea of liberation, of freedom, and that liberation, freedom sometimes was associated with what is called the deathless. And it might also be translated as immortality. And so they vowed that they would go off and discover liberation, that was more important in the context of this life that they were living than what they were doing in the festival. And so they went off and studied with one of the great teachers of the area, and very quickly mastered his teachings. And he mastered them so well that he wanted to make them teachers. And they said to him, "Is this the extent of your teachings? This is as far as it goes." And he said, "Yeah, this is as far as it goes." And they said, "Well, it's not enough. You know, we're not liberated. We're not free yet." And so the two friends, Sariputta and Mahamudgalyana, made a promise to each other that they would go off traveling around India, visiting spiritual religious teachers of all kinds, try to find the truth, try to find liberation. And whoever found the deathless first would come and tell the other one. And so they did for a long time. And they what it meant is that they were engaged in a very sophisticated culture of exploring what it means to be alive, what are the options, what are spiritual practices, how does one practice, what does practice lead to, what does it entail, what responsibility does individual have, what can individual do, what depends on the gods, what's predetermined, all these big questions that Indians were engaged in at that time. And in all their exploration, they didn't find liberation. So they went back to their hometown, or close to it, and it was soon after the Buddha was awakened. They didn't run into the Buddha, but one of the first disciples of the Buddha, early on, was sent out to go teach. And Sariputta ran into him. And he was so impressed by, first, that how calm and peaceful this man was, and radiant he was. He had never seen someone with this kind of radiance. And he was a monk, clearly, so that meant he was a spiritual person, practitioner. And so Sariputta said, "Well, you know, what practice do you do, and who is your teacher, and what is the doctrine of your teacher?" And this Buddhist monk said, "Well, I'm just new to this. I'm a new student, practitioner, follower of the Buddha, so I can't really explain so well." And Sariputta said, "Well, you should try me. You know, it's my responsibility. Teach me what you know. Teach me the essence of it. And it's my responsibility to figure out how to apply it or what it means." And that's a kind of a beautiful thing, that the idea that it's your responsibility to somehow take it in and receive it and work with it and not just wait until it's hand-delivered. So this monk then recited this verse. And this is the verse. And we don't know if it comes from the Buddha himself, which I said in the beginning of the talk, but it came from this certainly from this disciple of the Buddha, And this verse is what became often repeated. And translation I have of this verse is, of those things that have a cause, the Buddha teaches the cause and their cessation. Of those things that have a cause, the Buddha teaches their cause and their cessation, how they come to an end. This is the teachings of the Buddha. So most people are going to be perplexed. Why was this so important? But Sariputta got it. When he heard those teachings, they were enough to catalyze in his mind his liberation. And for the first time, he experienced or had a taste of liberation or the deathless. And so because of that, he was going to fulfill his promise, and he went and found his friend, Mahamoggallana. And he recited those verses, the verse to him as well, and Moggallana got it right away too. And then they both went to see the Buddha. And immediately the Buddha got a sense, these people are special. And he kind of immediately kind of made them his kind of chief disciples. They weren't fully awakened yet, and so they practiced with the Buddha for a while until they got their full awakening. So what is it about this teaching, this very brief teaching, that is so powerful, so significant, that someone who's well-trained, well-reflected, understands these things, could use those teachings to somehow get released, be liberated? The things, of those things which have a cause, the Buddha teaches their cause and their cessation. So one of the implications of this is that there are things that have a cause. Those things that have a cause, the cause and the conditions bring them about, are not inherent. They don't have inherent permanence. Maybe they have no inherent value, but certainly have no inherent permanence status. And so because they're not inherent or intrinsic to this life, if we understand the cause, and more than just understand it, but maybe end the cause, remove the cause, then that thing will no longer be there. So it's not particularly interesting as a universal, maybe as a universal principle, but if you understand where it's how to apply it in particular areas of your life, it's very significant. So if you have a thorn in your foot, and your foot hurts as you walk, and you assume, well, it's intrinsic to human life that I'm supposed to have a thorn in my foot, it's predetermined down through the ages. The gods wanted me to have a thorn. It's my karma to have a thorn, and I'm supposed to just bear it. There's all kinds of philosophies and teachings you can have about just leave it in there. Or you can understand that, yeah, you can, yeah, please. I'm a little bit allergic to it. So we move the cause. So if you understand that the pain in your foot comes from a thorn, and you understand that's the cause, and you understand that that there's a cessation, there's an end to that pain by pulling the thorn out, then you can have some confidence. You can have even some delight. You can have a sense of relief and maybe a sense of even freedom in your mind, just knowing that this is possible. Finally, I've been going around with this thorn in my foot for years, and wow, I didn't know that I could take it out. This is great. So we carry thorns in our minds, in our hearts. And some of those thorns people carry with them for a lifetime. And if you understand that the thorns, the pain, the suffering, the despair, the sadness, the regrets, the resentment, the clingings that we have are there because of a cause, and it's possible to end that cause, then it offers a lot of hope in this life. This is the good news. If your suffering is inherent to life, you're required to have it because it's predetermined. It's just the way human condition has been set up. If you think that it's from the gods, and you just have to kind of pray to the gods, and hopefully they'll do something good for you, or there's nothing you can do except maybe hope that in the next lifetime things will be better, then there's all kinds of reasons why people just kind of feel like they're stuck. Or sometimes people are stuck because they simply can't see the cause, don't see what the thorn is. But if you can understand well the cause and feel some sense of agency, ability to do something about the cause, then perhaps our suffering and despair can come to an end. And so this is, I think this is what Sariputta understood. And he immediately understood his role, what he could do. Whereas perhaps in all his traveling around India, no one had really pointed to the idea of a cause that was particular, that he had some agency or control, or control is not the right word, but agency or some role to address. In a sense, in modern terminology, we could say that there was a psychological understanding, understood the psychology of suffering, and understood how the psychology of suffering comes into be. Much of what we carry with us psychologically is not inherent, but rather, you know, comes together with the conditioning and beliefs and reactions that we have. So an interesting exercise, I think, to kind of maybe one way of applying this or looking at this is to see what happens when you meditate. And to consider what you bring with you when you meditate. That's not inherent to that period of time that you're meditating. So, you know, you've set aside a period of time. Here at IMC Sunday morning, it's 35 minutes to meditate. It's not inherent that you have to think about the auction. How am I going to, you know, what am I going to bid on the auction? And it's the last day, and, you know, I really want that thing, and what's a good, you know, you don't have to think about that. It's not inherent to this period. Or you don't have to think about your taxes anymore, maybe. Even if you still haven't paid, submitted your taxes, you don't have to, you know, it's not inherent to the situation that you have to think about your taxes. There's a lot of things that are not inherent to what necessary has to happen. But if you watch your mind, you can see how much you bring with you. You bring a lot along. And if you believe it's inherent, you believe that's necessary, then you'll lock onto it or continue it or perpetuate it. But if you see it's not necessary, does it change your relationship to it in some way? And what change might that be? So, for example, when I was a relatively new meditator, I brought a lot of things with me about meditation itself. One was that I meditated my first years of practice at the Zen Center, where we meditated together. You meditate with your eyes open, so you're kind of aware of the people around you, more than maybe here, I don't know. And one of the things I brought with me was I had to meditate in order to look really good in their eyes. You know, and I had to meditate in such a way that my teachers would approve of me. So I'd be sitting there wondering what that was like and trying to do it. Or I had brought these ideas that my the meditation was a time to become a super spiritual person. I was going to be like the great star. And this kind of ideation of grandiosity came in, was there, you know, sitting straight, late into the night. Hopefully someone noticed. Or sometimes it was the other side, because the pendulum will swing, right? Is, I'd bring with me, I'd just come in and sit down to meditate, and I'd bring with me, I don't know what I'm doing. I can't do this. This is too difficult. I'm a disgrace to Buddhism. All kinds of, kind of self-deprecating thoughts, I'd bring it with me. And the two kind of came together as a pair, I think. Sometimes thinking how great I was, thinking how terrible I was. It's, to swing back and forth, the pendulum swings, it's kind of exhausting. Is there an alternative to this kind of ideation, to bringing this kind of idea with you? And then as I learned more about meditation practice, then I brought with me all these shoulds. I'm supposed to get concentrated. I'm supposed to have a mind that doesn't wander off. I'm supposed to be filled with compassion. I'm supposed to, all these things. And I had this, you know, so then I would start judging myself, you know, because, well, I'm not getting concentrated. I'm not so compassionate. Or I would judge myself, you know, maybe the pendulum would swing, and wow, I'm really concentrated today. Boy, this is really good. And then I would bring this judgment. So I would bring into the situation judgments about the situation. This is good, this is bad, I'm doing great, I'm doing terrible. Are these kinds of reactions, thoughts, are they inherent to the situation, or are they brought into the situation? And I propose that they're all brought in. They're not inherent to the situation. And so what happens when we see them as not inherent, to see them as something that arises because of causes that don't have to be there, can we let go of them? Can we bring the cessation of them? Can we let them go? Can we drop them? And what is it like to be present without bringing anything into the situation? And I think for me, that was one of the great lessons of Buddhist meditation, was learning what it's like to be alive, what it's like to be present, without bringing anything along with me, without bringing anything to the experience. So, sit and meditate, and the mind wanders. Sit and meditate sometimes, and maybe I feel irritated that day. Sit and meditate, and I feel calm that day. Can I have those experiences be there without bringing anything to them, adding anything to them? So if I'm sitting there and feeling, I have a wandering mind, there's a simple recognition that this is a wandering mind. This is how it is. As opposed to, oh no, uh-oh, hope no one notices. Or this is bad, or, you know, I'm not doing this right. There's so many things to bring, to pile on top, pile all this stuff on top of it. But it's possible to have a wandering mind and not bring anything to that except the simple recognition this is what's happening. And in that simple recognition, there's some freedom there. There's some peace there. There's no pendulum that swings in that. We're not caught in the experience and the reaction. And it's a hard lesson to learn because, especially in meditation, there can be all these ideas that we have, sometimes because you're listening to people like me too much, that maybe you're supposed to kind of be completely still and non-wandering mind or something. And, you know, there's some kind of standard in which you're measuring yourself against, and I'm not matching that standard. Gil can sit there and not move for 35 minutes. Wow, but I can't. I feel like I need to move, you know. And, you know, so therefore I am, and then we fill in something. Therefore I am meant for boogie-woogie dancing. That's the way for me. True spiritual path. And but just to kind of see something is happening inside of us. Desire to move, wandering mind, irritation, calm, settledness, and then learn the art, the ability to be very simple with it. Just let it be. Don't bring anything to it. Or if you do bring something to it, to see it as something, because it's a cause and condition that comes and can cease, if it's easy enough, to let it cease, to let it fall away. Sometimes it falls away by itself by just relaxing around it and not making a big deal of it. Making a big deal of anything in meditation is counterproductive. So if you have a wandering, busy mind, making a big deal of it doesn't help. The Suzuki Roshi said apparently at one point, don't be bothered by your thinking. And that was, when I heard that, I thought that was really helpful for me because I was so bothered. Got to do something with this thinking mind. But don't be bothered. I gave the Wednesday morning here at IMC, last Wednesday, I gave the instruction as kind of an exercise to people for the meditation session to practice only letting go of their thoughts, just let go of thoughts, just let go, let go, let go. The only thing they do is let go. And several people said, that didn't work. Because the more they tried to let go, the more their mind got busy and churned up and agitated. So even letting go can be, to bring too much. And so what about not bringing anything at all? And so in the period of meditation is a very special, unique time in a person's life, I think. Because it's one of the, I hope we can see it as one of the very few times in life where it's completely clear that you don't have to do any of the conventional things that people need to do in their lives. You don't have to, work out on your taxes. You don't have to solve all your problems. You don't have to become a good meditator. You don't have to defrost the freezer. You don't have to, there's a lot of things, a lot of shoulds, a lot of things that probably should happen in your life. But when you sit down to meditate, the idea is to put all that aside and then see, can you experience yourself? What is it like to experience yourself without bringing anything to the situation? Any thoughts, any judgments, any ideas, any memories, any history, any expectations, any projections into the future? Just, what's it like to become simpler and simpler that way? To allow yourself to become simpler. Part of that is to know that you can't just turn off what goes on. We bring things. There's all this habit momentum in our mind. And so part of that then is to learn how not to bring more to the bringing. How not to add on layers and layers on top, but rather to step back and say, oh, here I am doing this again. Here, or not even that, here what's happening is I'm trying to get concentrated. This is what trying to get concentrated looks like. And if we step back and see, kind of like your anthropologist from Mars, and you say, wow, I get to study, I get to investigate, research what it's like for these human beings on the planet Earth to have a mind that wants to get concentrated or have a mind that's judging itself negatively. I'm a bad meditator. Boy, this is interesting. Step back enough. So you can say, so you can kind of turn around and look at yourself and say, wow, isn't this interesting? As opposed to fighting it or believing it or getting involved in it. And that movement of stepping back or stepping around or turning around and looking back at it can be part of this moving into becoming simple, moving into not bringing anything anymore. To have the experience of being aware of whatever's happening, even our reactivity and all the things we bring, but experience that the awareness, the knowing, the mindfulness can provide freedom. The mindfulness can provide spaciousness or clarity or openness or overview of the situation in such a way that we are not caught by it anymore. So what do you bring? And is it necessary to have it there? And can you bring it to an end? And just have very simple, just be simple. It's a long process for many people, but even knowing this idea can be meaningful. So to begin to get a sense of this in meditation, and to begin having, to think of it as a slow unfolding of learning how to do this. It's not like you can do it overnight. That's something else we bring. Now I know how to do this. I'm supposed to sit down and do it immediately, snap my fingers, and just sit there and be simple. That's more bringing, right? Any idea of how you should be, or supposed to be, or shouldn't be, or not supposed to be. But once you start getting a sense or a taste or feeling for what it's like in meditation to be simple and not bring more, and step back and allow things to be, and because in meditation you don't have to bring anything, then you can begin bringing with you that sense, that feeling, that understanding into the rest of your life outside of meditation. And outside of meditation, there's a lot of compelling things that have to be done. And so it's a little bit harder in daily life to learn how to do this, but if you have a feel for it, you can begin have a little more wisdom about when to become simple and when to not be simple, when you don't bring anything to the situation and when it's actually useful to bring things to the situation. When you're supposed to think about things and even evaluate things and when not to evaluate things. Or you become wise to see clearly, oh, now I'm evaluating. Someone's walking down the street and you evaluate them in a particular way and you see, oh, this is an evaluation. I know what it's like to bring something. This is I'm bringing something here as opposed to assuming that my evaluation of the person is the truth. Many people can go through life assuming that whatever they think is the way things are. But if you can watch and see how thinking arises, evaluation, judgments arise in the mind, you see your role that you bring to the situation, then you can put a question mark after it and say, I'm evaluating this person this way. I'm judging this person this way. I have this reaction to this person this way. Let me look more carefully. Let me see, is this really the case? To give the person a second chance to not be, you know, limited by your first reactions or response to who the person is. Or in many situations, you know, the situation is kind of, for the purpose of the talk, I'll say neutral, but what do we bring to it? And to become aware of what we bring to it. So I don't know if this is the best example, but thinking about this theme this weekend, I thought, remember, I've ridden a lot of public transportation in my lifetime. And then I was remembering all the things that I brought with me when I was sitting there on the bus. So when I was a little kid, like 6 years old, taking the public bus to kindergarten by myself, the thing I was most concerned about was recognizing the stop to get off. And that's what I was focused on. And then when I was a teenager, I mostly noticed the other girls. That was what stood out. And then at some point later in my life, I mostly noticed what people were reading. I kind of like to read and stuff. Oh, look at that book. Or at some point, I just became interested in all the people there, the sociology of buses, and what's going on. So I was a little more open, right, not selecting one category. And lately, it's been their technologies. You know, what are they looking at there? Pushing buttons at them. And so I bring something, or I bring a selection process. So to be aware that there's a selection process, but where we're bringing, you know, all those selection processes is only a segment of what's happening in that situation. If we see that we're segmenting it and focusing on a particular thing, that's what we bring, then we have the ability to say, to ask ourselves, is this the wisest thing to do at this time? Maybe it is. Maybe it's an innocent and fine thing to do. Or maybe this is not the way I want to live my life. Maybe there's other ways, other things to do. Maybe there are more useful ways. I've been on public buses and decided that the most beneficial thing for me to do was not to go along with my automatic selection process or whatever it was that particular era, but rather to sit there and see if I can generate loving kindness for the people around, some sense of friendliness or openness and generosity to them. And I thought that was really nice. It was a very nice thing to do. So what do we bring? And is it possible to not bring so much? Is it possible to be wise what we bring and what we don't bring? To have the experience in meditation of shedding so much of the bringing, to giving up, not being so involved with all the bringing, all the doing, all the shoulding and shouldn'ts, and have a radical simplicity of being, maybe not in some abstract idea of what being radically simple is, but a radical simplicity in the simple act of being mindful, of recognition, of knowing. Here, this is what it's like now. And find some relief, some peace, some joy, some happiness in that simplicity of just knowing, this is how it is. This is how it is now. To do that might seem like it doesn't have much worth or value. But I like to suggest that it's probably one of the most valuable things you can do. And it doesn't make you a weak kind of empty person in some negative way, but actually it gives you tremendous power over the situation. Because then you have a certain kind of power and control over yourself. And you have the ability then to enter into and choose much better what to do and how to respond than if you're on automatic pilot, which is what happens when we bring a lot into the situation and live in that bringing. So of those things that have a cause, the Buddha teaches their cause and their cessation. So I hope that this idea of looking at what we bring into the situation somehow applies or, you know, touches on one aspect of this famous verse for you. And I hope that you learn to step back from all that you bring to the situation and learn the beautiful thing of beginning to open up to the situation with what in Buddhism sometimes is called beginner's mind, or the not-knowing mind. Probably more situations than you realize you'd benefit from entering into them without preconceived ideas or preconceived agendas, and just showing up and looking around. What is that? What's now? What is this? So I hope that your meditation practice teaches you, shows you how to live without preconceived ideas, agendas, bias, and shoulds and shouldn'ts. And then we'll see what happens next.